Well, let's see. This is Bob Brundage again. The date is June the 26th. We're at the 45th National Square Dance Convention in San Antonio. I'm talking tonight to Betsy Gatta and her husband, Roy, and we're about to get started. So, Betsy, tell us a little bit about how you got started into square dancing and what your family life was like and so forth.
Okay, well, Bob, there wasn't much of a time in my life when I haven't square danced. My parents started when I was probably a baby or three, somewhere before I really remember. I started when I was five going on six. The caller who taught my parents had a club for children, actually a series of dances for children at the YMCA in Metuchen, New Jersey. To the best of my recollection, what he did was on Friday evening, he started early, maybe 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and he worked people from kindergarten through third grade, and then 4 through 6 or 7, and then the junior high and high school kids all in one evening. And we did what we would now call the Eastern style visiting couple dances and mixers, things that would now be called traditional dancing because that is what the dancing was at that point in time. And what that, of course, has given me is the background to call that kind of dances basically from my childhood memories, which is very, very fun. Unfortunately, he also, besides calling, was working a full-time job and had a heart attack when he was younger than I am now and was told to slow down and didn't. So when I was about eight, he had to stop calling, basically because I believe he died. The man's name was George Swanick. But in the meantime, I had been dancing with my parents. And, of course, at that time in the early 50s, this would have been 52 when I started, 1952, in the grade school where I went to, they had square dance, family square dances, probably once or twice a year as fundraisers. So I would go with my parents to those dances. And my parents, who had been involved in the dancing, started going to conventions. I remember they went to the New England convention when I was probably six or seven. I did not go along. I was too young. I stayed with my grandmother. However, my dad has a story that I've heard for many years. They knew the caller, Ricky Holden, who was then very famous on the East Coast. And Ricky Holden was a very charming man, and a lot of people did things for him. And he talked my mother into giving him a ride to Boston for the New England Convention, or actually it was the Atlantic States Convention that was in Boston.
Right.
And he was going to help with the driving. And what happened was there was a snowstorm, because these conventions were in the fall, and they got an early snowstorm. And my mother fell asleep, and my Ricky fell asleep, and my dad drove all the way to Boston in the snowstorm. So the story goes, of course, we have the accent difference. And he pulled into Boston after this long drive and muttering about the fact that nobody helped him like he had been promised. And the bellman came out and said, "Pack your casa." And my dad said, "Hell no, unpack it, I just got here."
Really good.
But the friendship continued regardless. And one of the first dance weeks that we went to, we used to go to a week camp that was sponsored originally by Folkcraft Records, which was owned by Frank Kaltman.
Frank Kaltman, right.
And they were based then in Newark. Right. I remember going there, and they had two Doberman pinschers that were like as big as I was.
Nosy.
Yeah, nosy. And we would, but they had, Frank and Ricky Holden started a dance camp, which the first year met in New Jersey in, I think, Stokes State Forest, in one of the camps there. They subsequently moved it to Kentucky, and it has now turned into the Kentucky Dance Institute after many years. But we went there, and my folks stayed in contact with Ricky Holden for years and years and years. In 57, and this is, well, it's all related. In 57, I actually got a really good grade on a school project because Ricky Holden had been abroad, not interviewing. He was taping folk dances for for Folkcraft Records, and he was in Hungary just about the time of the revolution. And I did a school project. I did an interview with him, and got a very good grade because he had a first-hand knowledge of what was going on in Hungary.
That's great.
So, in the meantime, I would go to the dances and I would dance with my dad, and I was very frustrated because if my dad was dancing with me, other people might ask my mom to dance, but nobody ever asked me. So at one of the Atlantic States conventions in Washington, I made a button that everybody found very funny, and it was one of those big picture buttons, and I covered it with paper and said, "I can dance, ask me." It didn't work, but everybody had a good time laughing at it.
Good. And your dad, by the way?
My dad's name was Art Seeley. And he started calling somewhere in the late 50s. At the Kentucky Dance Institute, they had they did a caller school. They did all kinds of dancing. They did square dancing, folk, international folk dancing, what constituted round dancing then. When they were in Kentucky, they did play party games, which would be the Kentucky version of dancing. As long as I understood it, as long as there was no played music, the Bible preachers did not object to it and call it dancing. So in that sort of dancing, everybody sung the lyrics, and you danced a pattern to your singing. And we did that, and there was a caller school. And so I'm sure my dad got started calling then, but I don't really remember. It was just, it was always there.
Right.
And I went to the caller school, and Ricky Holden was one of the teachers, my teachers in calling, when I was 11. I went with my dad. And at that point in time, at the end of the week, everybody who'd been in the caller school had to call one dance at the Saturday evening dance. And the first dance I ever called was Chase the Rabbit. And there were no monitors. We had a Bogan turntable, and there were no monitors, and I really couldn't hear the music, and I was scared to death. And Ricky Holden beat the time on the table for me, and I, evidently from what people told me, I did a wonderful job. However, I was so tense and upset by this, I went outside, sat on the steps, and cried for half an hour and vowed I would never, ever do this again. I was going to dance. I wasn't going to call.
Right.
So I continued going to dances, and now I'm getting old enough so that we could get into the teenage thing.
Right.
And teenage dancing, depending on your area of the country, was getting quite popular. We started going to national conventions in 1961. And the first year, my parents sent me off on the kids' tours, and I told them, I'm missing too much dance time. Don't do that again. So in 62, we were in Miami, and I would have been 14. And there was a girl caller, Charlotte Watkins. I think she was about 16. She called in the youth room. And she was so smug about the fact that she was a caller that I looked at my partner and said, I could do that. And I went home, and my dad had a teenage club by then. He was calling for a group called the Church Mice, who had gotten started from another club that had kids in it, but they wanted their own space to dance. So they started this club and had my dad, Art Seeley, call for it. And this was a perfect place for me to start practice calling, and I did. And out of that club, my dad trained not only me, but another caller named John Sweeney, who is still working actively, another caller named Ron Weiss, who's in Delaware, who is still working, and a young man by the name of Bob Witt, whom I don't know. I heard at one point he may still be doing like one night stands, beginner parties, but I don't really know. We've lost contact with Bob.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all of these people learned to call in the early 60s, and they're now probably in their late 30s and still calling.
Good.
Okay, let me breathe. Okay, so now we've gotten to the early 60s. So having started calling, I figured I should go ahead and start being more public about it. The next national convention in Minneapolis-St. Paul in 1963, you will find the name of Betsy Seeley on the program in the youth room. You won't find Betsy Gatta because she didn't exist yet. And that was the first place I called it a national, and I've called it every national since then. I was in high school then, and I continued to call and dance, and I went to college. I actually made the final decision of where I was going to school based on the fact that near Frederick, Maryland, I knew less than an hour away there were teenage square dance friends, and I could have a social life. If I didn't meet anybody to date, if I could get into Silver Spring, Maryland, I could go square dancing. And that was how I actually made the final decision of where I went to school, because both of these schools were my final choices were equal in academic standards and ratings like that. While I was at college, my dad and I would do the father-daughter weekend square dance every year, and a lot of people kind of made sure they came out and danced with us, and it was a very big event for us. And I continued, as I said, to work with my dance with my friends and call a little bit down in Silver Spring and Falls Church, Virginia, when I wasn't trying to get through school. In the meantime, my father had started calling for the Rutgers Promenaders when I was in high school. And that was an on-campus college-age club. They started, how old are they now, Roy? They're 37?
Oh, no,
40. 42. They're 42 years old now. This is 96, so they started to subtract 54. And they had several different callers before my dad. And actually, I called the first dance by myself for the Rutgers Promenaders, and we have to segue back a little bit to when I was in high school. My dad was sick. I actually had a cold, too, but he was, like, in the bed. He was not going to get up and go call the square dance. I had no driver's license because in order to drive in New Jersey, you had to be 17. I was 16. I was a high school sophomore. And my mother drove me up, and we went on campus. I was scared to death. These were college people. I called, and I did mostly singing calls then. I called everything I knew. In between the sets, and I did two singing calls, and then they took a break, and two singing calls, they took a break. In between the sets, my mom made me hot tea, and somebody gave me sour lemon drops, and I sucked on the sour lemon drops and drank hot tea and kept my voice. And when I did everything I knew, the dance wasn't over, so I started in again. At the beginning, I did everything over again until okay. The day. And they didn't care. They were perfectly happy to dance.
Right.
And I survived. But that was my first dance all by myself.
Good.
After college, the Rutgers Promenaders had never had lessons. When we moved off campus, the then college advisor told us when he was in school, at the beginning of the semester, they put up a notice on campus, anybody who wants to square dance, come out, and the square dance club is going to meet this night. And they just started off, and they taught people as they went. And towards the end of the semester, when the projects and the exams were getting too heavy, they didn't get a square out, then they stopped activities for the semester. And then they started in again next semester. So my dad thought that maybe they should do some lessons. This was 1969. And he didn't really have the time, and he basically said, "Here, why don't you let Betsy do the lessons?" Because I was out of school and kind of looking to establish myself as a caller, you know, as a grown-up adult caller,
right,
as opposed to a teen caller. So the first set of lessons was done on campus. Every lesson was in a different building, and it was 5 weeks long. And the challenge was finding where the lessons were that week. And, you know, but this was more than they'd ever had, so they
right.
were perfectly happy. And, of course, they were college students and used to learning. They learned like crazy. After that, I said it was too short. The next year, the next semester, they got 10 weeks, and we did mainstream in 10 weeks. And we did various positions, and you know, it was rough and scrambled, but they got through it because they were young and interested. And I taught lessons twice a year from 1969 until about 1991 when they moved off campus and we started changing our patterns to fit everything. Before we were done, we stretched the lessons to 13 weeks, and that was all we could squeeze in any semester. But the problem was we couldn't go to the second semester because it was a good six-week break. And it wasn't like adult education classes where you can schedule five-week lessons in between some place that's close. All these people went home for that six-week break. They weren't even in the state necessarily.
Right.
So we went through in one semester. The interesting thing about that is because they learned early, they had a good square dancing experience, a lot of people either remember it fondly or once their kids have grown, they come back. They may drop out to raise the kids, but they come back. They seem to come back afterwards. So during the course of this, I was doing lessons. I met a young woman named Donna Reed. And some, just like the actress, but not, she was not the same person. And she went through lessons, square dance lessons, and she was very interested in lessons. And she had this terrible boyfriend. And this terrible boyfriend he was kind of jealous, and he would let her go to square dance lessons, but he did not want her to go out to eat afterwards. So I had been involved with a young man who, I did not marry. I was engaged to him, but he was also very jealous, and I thought, this is not a good thing, and you should not date this man. I spent a whole semester telling this young woman that she should not date this guy because jealous men were just not the right people that you wanted to be around. And she brought him to this lessons the next semester, and he took lessons, and they split up. And about now, Roy, I need you to tell some of this, because this young man turned out to be the man I married. But I didn't know that at the time.
So now we're introducing you to Roy Gatta. Go ahead, Roy.
I'll talk briefly about what went on. So yes, my fiance and I broke up, and I dropped out of the lessons, probably somewhere around lesson four or five, and said, I don't need this, because I was only doing it to keep this young lady happy. But another young lady from the club had a very persuasive method to get me to come back into lessons again, so I came back somewhere around lesson seven and picked it right up again. I was fortunate enough to not find it too difficult. And so I graduated from the lessons at the Rutgers Promenaders, and that was the spring of 72, and was glad that I did. And the following year, at the beginning of the semester, there was a square dance, and a couple of girls from over at the Douglas College called me up at my fraternity, said, look, we're going to a square dance. Betsy's calling, and it was someplace up in the boondocks of New Jersey. And I said, yeah, it's okay with me, but you girls have to drive, because I've kind of been drinking a little bit here at the fraternity. So we went up and got lost, got there in time for the very last tip, and Betsy was sharing the program with somebody else, and she was not calling the last tip. So they needed somebody to fill the square. So I said, well, okay, I'll jump in. And Betsy jumped in, and we danced, and we started talking about this and that. And the next thing you know, we just agreed to dance together at an upcoming convention in September. And basically, by Thanksgiving, we were engaged and have now been married for 22 years. And are one of the unusual teams in the country where the female part of the couple is the caller, and of course IQ round dances.
And when did you get started on round dancing?
Got started in round dancing in 1978. The Rutgers Promenaders had just the year before started dabbling with round dances. We had always done them at the club. It was one of the old-fashioned type of deals where there was, I think, three round dances that the club always learned from memory: Frenchie Brown, Flipside, and Street Fair. And the club could just do them.
They also were doing a couple of folk dance type things. Dubletska Polka and the Salty Dog Rag were very popular. And again, they didn't need cues for those either.
Right, people just simply did them. But the previous year, somebody had, one of the young men in the club had started introducing some round dancing. The club seemed to like it. So we got to the first dance in September in the fall of 78. And somebody said, I don't even remember his name, but somebody said, where's so-and-so to do the rounds? And they said, oh, he graduated and moved to New York.
I had a job offer.
I had a job offer. So they said, well, why don't you cue rounds? I said, why should I cue rounds? And they said, well, you and Betsy are the only ones that know how to round dance. So I said, okay. Well, and they said, oh, you know how to round dance, and she's got the equipment. So that's how I started cueing, and that was 18 years ago. And it works out nicely because as a team such as this, when you can do both, people hire us as a team, you know, all around the country.
Right.
It works out well.
That's great.
Okay. So in the early 70s, I was living in South Jersey, and I was working for the Rutgers Promenaders and doing guest spots in and around Philadelphia area because that was the closest to where I was. And from there, after Roy and I became engaged, I started trying to change my venue to working more in North Jersey. And I found, and I have to say, I found it was made easier for me in North Jersey by the fact that there had been a woman caller, I believe from Long Island, named Beulah Samick.
Beulah Samick, yeah.
And she was an excellent caller.
Right.
And because of the fact that there was a good woman caller who was known in the area, there was probably much less prejudice or...
Okay.
So anyway, because Beulah was a good woman caller, there was probably less resistance. I don't want to say prejudice. I mean, too many people talk about prejudice. There was less resistance to the idea of a woman calling, and it was a very unusual thing in a lot of areas. There are still a much smaller number of women calling than there are men. We know that. But I never felt like I was going around blazing any trails. I was just me doing what I was doing because I loved the activity. And I've continued to call for the Rutgers Promenaders, and I still do, and they're still in existence. Still a mainstream club, but we'll get to that.
Excuse me, is Beulah Samick still calling or working?
No. When Beulah had a stroke a few years ago, and
okay.
It affected some of her memory, and she is no longer able to call. She was around up until a few years ago, you know, and she is still remembered fondly by a lot of dancers that
right.
I talk to.
Yeah.
So, anyway, what I wanted to move into was the caller school. My first caller school was sponsored by a dancers association, the Northern New Jersey Square Dance Association, in 1973, the summer before Roy and I were married. They decided that they needed more to train callers, and there was no callers association active at that time in Northern New Jersey. So the dancers association talked to different people, and they had actually two schools run by four different callers. One was in Northern New Jersey and one was on Staten Island. And they had my dad and I work on Staten Island with these callers. And we turned out, without really planning it, because of our different personality types, we turned out to play good caller, bad caller. My dad would rip the people apart into little shreds. He critiqued this. This was bad. This was not good. This, you didn't change this. Da, da, da. And he went on, and I was there with, but you have moved this around, and you made a recovery here, and we went back and forth. And of the people that we trained the first year, one of them is Frank Ravicchio, who is still working. Another one was named Al Moses, who worked until he passed away and started two square dance clubs in Brooklyn. Without Al, I don't think there would be square dancing in Brooklyn. Another one is named Bob Merkler. He never actually turned into a club caller. He he found a niche doing beginner parties, one-night stands, and he could present an excellent program there, which, of course, is a great way to publicize square dancing to the general public. So it was very exciting. And the fourth one is Marty Clifford, and I've lost track of him.
He moved to North Carolina.
He moved to North Carolina. I don't know if he's still calling or not. But all of these people worked for a good number of years, and some are still calling. Anyway, we did our first caller school there, and of course, it gave people a chance to hear and see me in a different way. There's still one couple who came out. They were dancer guinea pigs for these callers, and they still remember that school and how my dad took them apart and I put them back together.
Right.
So that was the first caller school that I ever worked on, you know, as a teacher.
Right.
So, okay, push the button. So now we've moved ourselves into the mid-70s. In 75, what I was doing was looking for different ways to expand my calling and perfect what I knew. And I started working with Contras. I had always danced Contras. I understood them, but I had never really called them to a large group. So I started working with that, and in 75 at the National Convention, I called Contras for the first time. And I was petrified. And I was especially petrified when I recognized in one line Bill Kastner was dancing, and in another line, Jim Mayo was dancing, and this kind of made me totally weak in the knees, but experience pays off because I was able to continue and finish the Contra. And, of course, once you start working with such things, I had choreography ideas. And I wrote a Contra. I wanted to include the call Flutter Wheel in a Contra because I thought it was a nice dance feeling thing, and I wrote something called the Flutter Reel. And Bill Kastner looked it over for me, and he got great joy out of the idea that we could write. He worked with me to write a totally smooth contour with a modern figure, just so he could kind of frustrate's not the right word. So he could just kind of show Don Armstrong that it could be done. Basically, Bill was looking for the venue through this contra that I had the idea for, to show Don Armstrong that modern square dance figures do time and phrase in a contra. And that was, I think, the first time that a flutter wheel was used in a contra. Now it seems to be an accepted thing. But that was one of the first time, that's the first time I can remember. I think I was the first person who did that. So We continued to call and cue, and I was working locally and starting to get some more regional bookings. People would hear me say at a national convention and they'd hire me. And these jobs were basically taken for the publicity value because I wasn't well enough known to get a tour together, so I'd drive from, you know, New Jersey to North Carolina and back, and by the time they paid me, I wasn't making a lot. I wasn't making any money. I was lucky to break even. But it was exciting because people were beginning to hear me, and I felt like I was really beginning to make myself known. And I went to my first caller lab in, let me get it right, 76. We were still in our house trailer. It was just before we moved to our house. And I came to Caller Lab, and I had all of this dancing background and all of this experience, but I really looked at the leaders of Caller Lab, and I thought, you know, the cat can look at a king. And I came in there with that idea, and I found that the sense of equality that people had generated was amazing. And I also realized by talking to people, because they treated me as equals, I could talk to these well-known festival callers and find out that, yes, they were on top and they were known by the dancers and they were hired, but they only knew square dancing. And I knew some of the folk dancing and the contra dancing and now the rounds that they didn't know. And I discovered when I came home from Color Lab, I realized I had a lot to offer different dance pictures. And that really I had never, ever realized that. It was just, I didn't know that everybody else didn't do it the same way. It was just the way I grew up.
Right.
So, of course, I came back and I was taken down to earth very quickly. Yeah. Roy picked me up at the airport, and on the way home, actually, he took me out to dinner. And on the way home, he told me that the sink had been stopped up in the trailer, and he needed me to hold the stopper down on one side so he could put the cleaner down, drain cleaner down the other side. And of course, he hadn't done any dishes since I'd been away because the sink was stopped up. Yeah. So I came to reality very fast. So after that, we moved into the 80s, we started dancing advanced. Now my father was very much against the advanced dancing. He was very traditional in his views.
Right, I remember that.
And he didn't feel that it was dancing, whereas I had once I had some experience with some of the callers who can make it smooth and dancing, I thought it was just another branch. I see the activity as a continuous sort of picture, and there are various points where people can stop if that is the part of the activity that suits them. And I don't see each separate item, you know, the contra dancing or the basic squares or mainstream or the clogging as a separate thing. I see that these are the choices that people have as a continuous pie or something. And you can eat as much of the pie as you want. And maybe some people only want a little piece and some people want 3/4 of it. But that's how I see it. Are we still moving? Hey, at this point in time, because that, you know, in the early 80s, because that's the way I saw it, I had no idea also why somebody couldn't like why not everybody could like contra dancing in advance or contra dancing in challenge. And I actually did impart some of this attitude to some of my friends whom I taught to dance. And I trained dancers who I'm happy to say and proud to say dance more than one program, and don't, you know, they may dance advanced, but they don't look down at just mainstream. And our home club, Rutgers Promenaders, is still a mainstream club. In northern New Jersey, we still have more mainstream dancing than a lot of areas. But it's a lot of clubs have gone to plus, and they dance what some people might say a shaky plus. But Rutgers dances mainstream, and they dance it from as many different ways as we can create. And I tried to explain this to a gentleman who comes out to the club sometimes. He's an older gentleman. He supports us faithfully. He and his wife round dance. They're wonderful people. But he just has no concept of how these people think. And he came up to me one night at Rutgers about 2 or 3 years ago. He started kind of giving me a lecture about I should workshop one plus call every night at this mainstream club, so if they went on a raid to a plus club, they wouldn't break down the floor. And I kind of thought, and I looked at him, and I looked at the couple behind him who were then in my challenge lessons, and the couple behind them a little bit off to the left who danced with my advanced club, and the couple behind them off to my right who danced a higher level of challenge than I ever think of dancing. And I said, no, I don't think you understand. If they want, they know that if they want to take plus lessons, they can go to where the plus lessons are offered. And they really honestly come here to dance mainstream, and this is their home club, and that's what they want to dance. I really don't think they want that. Because I knew that I could never explain to him that some of these people danced advanced and challenge and still came to the mainstream club because it was their social and their home club. He would have no idea. But it took me at least 10 years to understand that. I couldn't understand it to save my life.
Very interesting.
So in the 80s, I continued to expand in various directions. We learned advanced and we learned challenge. We were dancing with then with a man by the name of Bruce Bush, who, well, actually, we first danced with Lee Kottman, who, of course, invented half the figures on the face of the earth. He actually used this for guinea pigs more than once at his home club, so that I still look at a call and go, oh, I learned that at Colonial Squares. I can't remember the call. I just remember I learned it at Colonial Squares. But then Bruce Bush moved into the area. He was originally from Wisconsin, and then he moved to Maryland because of his job, and then he moved to New Jersey. And he was kind of the rival all of a sudden of Lee Kottman. They were entirely different calling styles, and the rivalry was only in certain people's minds, but those people really worried about it. But Bruce was very helpful. When I learned to call advanced, or I was going to learn to call advanced, Bruce heard about it, and I wanted to come out and listen to his lessons. And what he did was he offered me the idea that every lesson he would have me call teach a figure, or I would do the review tip or something. But every week I would do one tip that would allow me to teach and learn at the same time. And therefore, I would not be like the blind leading the blind and teach a set of lessons all alone. What I would do would be to teach and guide it and be guided. Mm-hmm. And that was immensely helpful. We met a man in the elevator today who set me up in 1989 or so, when convention was out in Seattle. And he actually knew my name, my voice, because Bruce Bush sold the teaching tapes. He recorded them and he sold them to various areas. And so I called for some programming glitch and I started to say, hello, my name is Betsy Gatta. And this guy said, oh, I know you, Betsy Gatta. This is Raleigh. And I heard your, I'm like, how did you know me? Oh, I hear your voice every week from Bruce's tapes. I never had any idea that this man would know my name. So through that, actually my name was being transported around the country, even when I was really unaware of it. And from there, I started calling my own advanced group. A man thought, we had Lee Kottman in North Jersey and Bruce Bush in Central Jersey, but down towards the shore area, there was nobody calling, and it was a good hour ride or more for them to come to Bruce. So this man actually set us up in a club. He got his church. He invited us to come down. We got some, we set out the flyers. Before we ever had dance number one, he retired and moved to North Carolina. But we still dance in the church that he got us. And the minister and I still, and the man has now passed away, but the minister and I still remember this. A very, very nice group has come out of that. It's amazing what square dancers will do for each other. So I'm expanding in the 80s in calling-wise in lots of different directions. And in order to continue trying to publicize things, I made a record. A man by the name of Ralph Trout then was doing a series of records. And I called one record for him. And before I ever got involved in making another record, I was teaching part of a set of lessons. It was a little complicated, but basically the man who was teaching the set of lessons retired and moved away halfway through. He hadn't planned it. He was kind of forcibly retired. So they needed to finish the lessons. So they called me, and I only had every other week free. I don't remember what I was doing on the off weeks, but I only had like first and third or second and fourth. So they had me do those I had and somebody else do the other set. So in this set of lessons was a couple named Ralph and Marilyn Nybart. And Ralph is an attorney and he traveled a lot. So he missed a lot of lessons. And they bought some teaching videos that were out then. And they helped a lot, but Marilyn especially told me that she thought Betsy is such a good teacher, we could do better in the videos. And so they came to me at the end of lessons with the idea to make teaching videos. And that's how I got involved in these teaching videos. Roy and I had thought about such things, but we're busy people, so we would never have gotten the project off the ground without this other couple. So first thing we did was research. We bought the videos that were then out. There was one group. And we looked at them and said, decided what we did not like. And what we did not like about those particular videos was that a full square was always on camera, rather than the number of people used to do the call. And they did a lot of normal dancing with swings and brain right and left and promenade that you didn't need to do to highlight the figure. So we focused on highlighting a figure so that if it's a star through that I was going to teach, only two people would be on camera to demonstrate initially while we did the walkthrough. And Marilyn set up a script that came from the sets and order books that were out, basically. And then we revised the script so that the definitions were correct. And we had the Color Lab definitions were coming into full focus then after umpteen thousand revisions. And we revised the script so that it was as technically correct as it could be, but still words that I would say. Because sometimes the technically correct words do not come out of my mouth easily. I have my own way of teaching. And we had to take out some of my own jokes. And they knew someone who worked for a recording studio, and they booked the studio, and we selected dancers based on a variety of age. We wanted to show that there were younger dancers in the square dance picture, so we had different ages. They were based on that they looked well together and danced and moved well. And the video, the dancing sequences were rehearsed, although, just enough so they got familiar, because I wrote sequences that were as much opposition as possible to show what was possible without, totally mind-boggling people. Although some people have told me the first time they saw videos, while they were in lessons, it was a little bit mind-boggling. After they danced for about a year or two, then they found they understood some of the things I'd done.
Right.
And we went into the studio, and we had a director and real cameraman, and we learned a lot. We learned all kinds of technical things. But they learned, too. The people in the studio did not believe that you could make a one-hour video in one day shooting. And they told me this. And if you look at the mainstream video, which was the first one we did, especially in the beginning, I looked totally petrified, because I was. I was convinced that whatever investment I had put in there was gone and not forgotten, because they convinced me that I couldn't make a one-hour video in one day shooting, and we couldn't afford 2 days shooting. By lunchtime, we had turned the tables and we had convinced them, because Marilyn had set up a schedule. And since we had the script and everything, she had a time frame for everybody, and we were on time. By lunch break, we were still right on where we belong. And Roy was our technical director, which meant that he sat in the director's booth and watched the camera as much as the monitor as much as possible for any technical glitches. There were still a couple that we missed. There's a good shoulder bump on Some Men Run Someplace in one of the three videos. I don't know which one. We only caught it later. But if we had to redo it, then we went back and redid it. So we finished the video, and first one was mainstream, then we did plus, and then we did the second half of basic. And from them I found out what fame was like, just a bit, because people started coming up to me, and they had the video, and they came up to me to tell me it did them good, which is wonderful to hear. And they came up to me to tell me all kinds of things like, you come into our bedroom every night, which surprised me a little. And I said, well, this is what movie stars actually feel. The people that they've never seen feel like you are their close friend because they see you all the time. It's a very interesting experience. And because these people had heard me and they liked me and they knew my voice, they would come to dance with me at a national, and I started getting hired by people. What happens is when you train dancers, after a certain point, they start dancing. They continue to dance. They will move up in the club structure until they become the people who hire the callers. They remember the folks whom they enjoy. And if you trained them and they enjoyed you, then you get hired. So I started getting hired in more different places around the country. And, of course, the more people hear you, if you continue to do a good job, which is something you work on constantly, at least I try to, then you get hired more. So my career kind of moved from the local with a few regional spots to a regional with a couple of festivals now. And I really feel like I'm being able to be hired in a lot of different ways and do what I like best.
Well, getting exposed at the national doesn't hurt either.
No, it doesn't hurt at all. And a couple of years ago, just so that I could get a name as in the challenge field, I worked and called at the non-staff dance at the National Challenge, and that allows me to be heard in a different place, because those dancers don't always overlap the current ones. Button. But the videos really have allowed me to be seen even more than a national and national challenge. The videos are where people got to know me. We've been successful in that they did what I wanted for me, which is to make people know me. They also paid for themselves, and I believe the other couple, Marilyn and Ralph, have made the profit that they wanted to, because recently we started talking about another project, which is to do the first half of the basic program, starting with circle left and circle right. People have called me and asked whether I had this, especially for some of the groups getting started in Europe. And we know the European videos are different, but there is a way to convert them, and I know that some people in Europe have seen our videos. But what we want to do with the beginning part of square dancing is make it accessible, make it useful, and make it something desirable for teachers in schools and people in universities, something that is of the quality that the teachers in the universities would be able to use this to teach the phys ed teachers, and the phys ed teachers would be able to use this to teach square dancing in a good manner, and then they could use the modern records that are out, like Jack Murtha's Diamond series, and I know there are other series that are being produced. We could even perhaps include, and this is a thought that I have, like a listing for these people so that they could have modern dancing, if the children get a good dancing experience in school, maybe they want to get into the activity. And we're looking for ways to get people in any way we can manage. Give them a good dancing experience, let them see how it is.
That's great.
Now I need to go back a little bit and talk about collar training. What Bruce Bush did for me, of course, he gave me a great idea when he allowed me to learn by doing an advanced. I had been working one-on-one with a couple of callers for several years at the Rutgers Club. We started when we were doing lessons. We had the building, and we were supposed to be over at 10:30, but nobody came. The building, they closed the building. We could still go out. Nobody could get in. But they didn't care if we stayed till 11. So we used to get volunteers to stay after lessons, and my friend Dan, who is now a member of Caller Lab and an active caller and well known regionally, he would practice on them, and I would critique him, and we did others. And, of course, after Bruce did the teaching thing for me, I thought, well, what a great venue. I'm still teaching lessons for Rutgers twice a year, once every semester. So there were several callers that I did the same thing for beginner lessons. I said, okay, you're going to teach this figure. And afterwards we critiqued them. And, of course, I could pick up anything that they left out right in the next tip because I was there. So that was how I got started in continuing to call or train. Of course, I did my first school back in 73, but I hadn't done any formal schools until I was involved with the College Council School in the early 80s. In the meantime, however, I'd been working one-on-one with different callers. When Caller Lab started to do the caller coach accreditation, I thought, well, gee, that would be really nice, but I don't teach caller schools. I teach privately. So I looked at the list of what the requirements were, and in, let me get it right, 83, I went to caller coach school. And there I looked at the list of requirements, and they had, you could do caller schools, or you could work in a one-on-one apprentice program. And from there, I started getting my credits together to qualify as a Caller Lab caller coach. Because I think some of the most exciting things are to teach new people to dance and to teach people who are interested to succeed at calling. Because there are some, when a dancer takes that step to becoming a caller, when they start to take that step, there are so many parts of calling that they don't have any idea exist. Because the good callers make it look easy. The good callers make it look like you always follow the music and the choreography always works. We know that that's not true, but we can fake it. In fact, I think it's easier to be a caller in that instance than it is a round dance cure. Because I can get out when my mouth betrays me. Roy has some quick thinking, but even so, it's much harder because the figures don't always work.
Right.
So I took the caller coach test and found that I took the sample test and found that I could pass it. So I took the main test with John Kaltenthaler at Pocono Pines, and then we set up the orals. So Randy Page had also qualified with the written test, and John thought that it would be a good thing to do two at one time. So he set it up so that John and I met in northern New Jersey, left my car in a parking lot, and he drove up to Connecticut, picked up Randy Page. In the meantime, Jim Mayo drove down, and we met about halfway at a restaurant. And that was where we did the oral examinations. But, of course, as soon as John Kaltenthaler got both Randy Page and I in the car, he started asking questions. I was talking recently with Tony Oxendine, who's just finished his orals. He said they asked him some question. He excused himself and went to the restroom so that he could think for a second because he knew the answer. I said, well, what do you do when John Kaltenthaler's got you in the car at 65 miles an hour? You can't get out and go to the restroom. You got to answer the question. But I found it very exciting because it was a different venue for them to ask these questions. They played us off one against another. They would have a subject and have assign us either the pro or the con and have us debate, which was very exciting. And I felt like, again, like my first time at Caller Lab, I felt like I all of a sudden realized my own potential. And I knew that what I had to offer was, again, a whole array of background that a lot of people don't have. And as you call, of course, your ego is involved, and things don't always go smoothly. You reach plateaus, you improve, and you do something, and a lot of people hire you, and then all of a sudden they don't hire you, and you wonder what you've done wrong. So these times when you realize that your peers respect you are very valuable because it brings it home to you and it reinforces your sense of the fact that you have something to offer the square dance picture. I know, you know, I'm sure you've experienced the same thing. So that's where we are now. So that's where we are now. And I also have been on the Board of Governors for 2 terms and I'm now in my 3rd term. And we were discussing, again, when I saw Tony Oxendine at Round 11, we were talking about why people run for the board. And it was that same sense of the fact that I could tie different people's viewpoints together that originally made me want to run for the board. I was the only person who was running for the board who could talk to the contra people and try and explain what they wanted to the challenge people and talk to the challenge people and try and explain what they wanted to the mainstream and plus people and understand the mainstream and plus people because I do that all the time also. And at that point in time, I was probably the only person that could do that. There are now people on the board who do mainstream through some of the high challenges. And there are people on the board who understand contra and possibly through advanced. But I'm probably still the only person who has that entire understanding. But now they're talking to each other, and I no longer feel like if I go off the board, I don't feel like the same misunderstandings would occur because now the people have changed and there are more universal viewpoints than and understandings there.
That's great. That's it's a wonderful thought. I see what you're driving at. So you think that's about it?
I think that's about it.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation, and we certainly look forward to putting it in the Lloyd Shaw Foundation archives. So again, this is Bob Brundage. We're broadcasting here from San Antonio, the 45th National Square Dance Convention. Looking forward to many more years with you, Betsy. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Bob.